This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Bill Murray broke into television playing wise guys and goofy characters on Saturday Night Live, and broke into movies the same way. In Caddyshack, he was a human cartoon, chasing a rodent with the same single-mindedness that Wile E. Coyote pursued the Roadrunner. And in movies like Stripes and Ghostbusters, he defined the laid-back wisecracker persona for a whole new generation of filmgoers and imitators. It was right after succeeding so wildly in those comedy films that Murray tried making the transition to drama as the star of The Razor's Edge. That attempt failed, but that was 20 years ago. Now he's gotten rave reviews and an Academy Award nomination for Best Dramatic Actor for his starring role in Lost in Translation. He plays Bob Harris, an American actor visiting Japan to film a commercial. He's all alone and feeling out of place. And so is a young woman named Charlotte, who's in town accompanying her photographer husband and killing time by hanging out in a bar. These two isolated characters end up confiding a great deal to one another.
What about marriage? Does that get easier?
That's hard. We used to have a lot of fun. Lydia would come with me when I made the movies, and we would laugh about it all. Now she doesn't want to leave the kids, and she doesn't need me to be there. The kids miss me, but they're fine. It gets a whole lot more complicated when you have kids.
Yeah, it's scary.
It's the most terrifying day of your life, the day the first one is born.
Yeah. Nobody ever tells you that.
Your life, as you know it, is gone. Never to return. But they learn how to walk and they learn how to talk, and you want to be with them. And they turn out to be the most delightful people you will ever meet in your life.
That's nice.
Terry first spoke with Bill Murray in 1991.
You actually started performing when you were in high school, right?
Well, everybody did, didn't they? I mean, no. I performed in high school just to get out of class. You know, that was the thing. You auditioned for a show, and you would get certain hours off in the afternoon and not have to do homework and, you know, be excused from certain things. Actually, at my school, as a boys' school, there were girls in these shows, so you could get out, and you even got to rehearse at night, which was really insane.
So musicals? What did you get to be in?
Well, that was The Music Man was the big one, because it was great because we had to rehearse for months to learn all these dance numbers and vocal numbers, and to work with girl dancers from Sacred Heart, you know, the high school girls. And these were like rich girls from downtown who drank, you know, like gin out of 7-Up bottles and stuff. So that was the best job I ever had, I think.
Well, I'm trying to imagine you. You were a dancer in The Music Man?
Yes, I was a dancer.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine you dancing in the chorus of a high school musical.
They wanted somebody who was big enough to lift up this one girl dancer, and they couldn't. The other people that auditioned, I walked by, and the auditions were going on, and there were a couple of very pretty girls in there, so I just walked in there, and they said you know, and I literally just did it just to see what was going on, and I was like the biggest guy by about 5 inches, so they said you're going to pick up the big girl, you know. And she was big. You know, I had to pick her up on my shoulder. She was large. It was just typecasting. It could have been Lou Ferrigno got the job. You know, he would have, Lou Ferrigno, you're a dancer? Yes, I am, you know, at once. I mean, it was really all about getting somebody up on your shoulders. But I don't regret it. Yes, I was a dancer, Terry, yes. And I still go out and dance every once in a while, although I don't do it on the Broadway stage.
Oh, I just know high school musicals had just the corniest choreography.
Well, actually, ours was just the rote one that came with the Music Man book. It wasn't bad. It was pretty good. So we were sort of doing pretty much the Shapoopy number from the musical.
Now, in the movie Tootsie, I think you improvised a lot of this role, but you played a very self-involved, kind of experimental playwright. Did you know a lot of people like that in theater?
Self-involved?
Yeah, what could I possibly be thinking of?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I always... Guys whose art was so precious that it couldn't be explained to people, you know, really, and asking a question was like, oh, man, if you don't get it, you know, that kind of thing. It was always, I always enjoyed that, you know. I enjoyed meeting, like, people like that because it gave me an opportunity to unleash, you know, the darker side of my own wit upon them, you know. And you just wait, and you could sit with them for an hour and a half, and then finally there'd be that opening, and then you could just put a dagger right through their gut, you know. Because anyone that, you know, that attitude was just, it just invited trouble. But some of the things I said is that self-involved guy, I really do believe, you know. So I wasn't just totally, I was just being a drunk and obnoxious guy, but some of the things were really true, just like these guys that I would meet, you know, had some things to say.
Well, what's something that you said in Tootsie that you really believed in, but was also kind of funny and ironic at the same time?
I wanted to have a theater that was only open when it rained.
You genuinely did?
Yeah. Well, I said that in the movie. Oh. I said I wanted to have a theater that's only open when it rains. And I believe that from my own experience in the theater, that the best audience you could ever have even was not a full house, but a house that was three quarters full because of a very bad, or half full because of a very bad storm, which had kept people away, and they hadn't bothered to come, and they would come in still shaking the water off their shoulders and their heads and their hats, and they'd still be wet. Their hair would be wet on the back of their neck. Because it grounded them in a reality. It made them it put them on the planet. They weren't dreaming, they were really on the planet. So they were ready. The ideal specimens. They lived here, you know.
Let's hear more from Bill Murray. He spoke with Terry again in 1999 as he was getting raves for his role in the movie Rushmore. That's the name of the private school where Murray, as a self-made millionaire and school benefactor named Mr. Bloom, gets to inspire some students and confuse others. In this scene, Mr. Bloom addresses the student body.
You guys have it real easy. I never had it like this where I grew up. But I send my kids here because the fact is, you go to one of the best schools in the country, Rushmore. Now, for some of you, it doesn't matter. You were born rich and you're going to stay rich. But here's my advice to the rest of you. Take dead aim on the rich boys. Get them in the crosshairs and take them down. Just remember, they can buy anything, but they can't buy backbone. Don't let them forget it. Thank you.
I asked Bill Murray if he related to the experience of attending an academy like Rushmore.
I did. I went to an academy. I went to a Jesuit academy in Chicago, in the suburbs, and most everybody had money. And I was one of the ones that did not have money. I worked in the summer, I caddied in the summer and made enough money to pay my tuition, and then my money was gone. That was pretty much the money I made. So I would go through the school year without sufficient funds. I didn't have a car and I didn't have, you know, really a wardrobe to speak of. I used to take a lot of abuse for wearing golf shirts to school. Golf shirt. Murray, golf shirt. You know, there were guys who would pimp you for wearing a golf shirt. I had inherited a collection of ill-fitting golf shirts from my older brothers, and that's what I wore to school.
Did you have a complex because you didn't have the money that the other students did, or you didn't have the clothes that they did?
I haven't heard complex in a while.
Me neither.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe I used the word.
Yeah,
I haven't either.
I haven't heard complex. I had issues.
Issues, that's right.
But I had complex issues there. I guess I had a complex. That's why I tip so heavy nowadays. I think I feel for people that, you know, when I see somebody working in a golf shirt, I my hands vibrate. Yeah, it was I guess I had a complex. It sounds worse than it was, but I remember it, and I remember growing up without it, and you know, I came from a big family and there wasn't spare dough. And, you know, and I get, you know, think about like a couple of weeks ago, I got very upset with my boys, my older boys, because I said, God, you spoiled rich kids. I'm a failure. I'm a total failure. And, you know, they got very sad. And, well, that's who you are, Dad. That's who you were, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they're actually really sweet guys. And, you know, I was just giving them some tough love. But to grow up without money and now have money is just kind of a, you know, it's a funny thing. I now loan money to the kids I knew in high school who've blown the money their parents left them, you know. That's a kind of fun thing, you know. But I don't know, to have a complex about it. Well, I knew I wanted to pay my own way, you know, and I felt very good to be able to provide my mother with things later in life. And, you know, I remember the first year I made more money in reruns than my dad ever made, you know, in a year. And I didn't even work. You know, it was just reruns. And
right.
I thought, it's a funny world, funny life. So I grew up that way, the same way this kid grows up in Rushmore, and I could see, you know, I remember when they said, well, you'd be playing a tycoon. I thought, a tycoon? I'm going to play a tycoon, and the more I thought about it, I thought, well, hell, I am a tycoon. I am a self-made tycoon of some sort, and I got a set of a blue-collar chip on my shoulder, and so that part of it was not hard.
I want to talk about another movie that I think is a really terrific film, and I regret that I think very few people actually saw it. And it's called Mad Dog and Glory. And the screenplay was by novelist Richard Price, who's probably best known for Clockers. And you play a loan shark in this who owns a comedy club and really wants to be a stand-up comic. And you even get to do stand-up as this mobster in the movie. You know a lot about delivery and comedy, but your character doesn't know a lot about it, particularly at the beginning of the film when he's really very stiff. And tell me a little bit about playing a comic who doesn't know what they're doing.
Well, I found that mobsters are, the ones I've met, are really funny people. You know, that's part of the paradox is that they're often the most charming people. And the terror of what they're like in their criminal side is almost hard to imagine. But his readings of his lines were had a menace to them. That, you know, it was his club. You could be thrown out if you weren't enjoying yourself, enjoying the act. And it gave him a confidence to say it any old way he wanted. And he talked almost like he was talking to his. To his posse, you know, to his own, what do they call it? What do the hoods call their group, you know, their gang. And it was an angry kind of comedian, you know. He was angry. He was, he had a chip on his shoulder, and he truly spoke down to his audience. At the same time was delighting in the fact that he was, that what he was doing and the way he spoke his comedy was now getting public notice. You know, he was charmed with himself. He was really enjoying himself.
Why don't we hear a scene from early in Mad Dog and Gloria where you, the mobster, are doing comedy at the club you own, okay, with a lot of your boys in the audience.
Cosa nostra. Our thing. Our thing, my ass. Cosa Nostra is Italian for cheap bastards. Cosa Nostra babies. Other babies, they're born, they cry, they go, wah, wah. Our kids, they cry, they go, what?
Yeah, he probably heard some comedian sometime say, well, you gotta work with your life. You gotta use your life as your comedy.
Well, in this movie, Bill Murray, you got to work opposite Robert De Niro. And De Niro plays a cop who's a forensic photographer, and he saves your life in a convenience store holdup. And to thank him, you loan him a beautiful young woman played by Uma Thurman, and you basically own this woman because she owes you about $75,000, and she pays it off by doing whatever favor you ask of her. And in this scene from later in Mad Dog and Glory, you've come to pick her up but De Niro doesn't want her to go because he's fallen in love with her. Let me play an excerpt of this scene.
Bring it down, Wayne.
I love her.
You love her.
I own her!
I knew it! I knew it! I knew it! Didn't I call it right on the nose when I saw you in the office? You're a schmuck if you don't think she's playing you like a violin right now. Women. F***ing women, you can't live with them, you can't kill them. Okay. If you want, you can assume the debt.
Assume the debt?
Yeah. Be my friend. For what, I don't exactly know. You're a cop. Maybe something, maybe nothing. You want me to forget about her for the next year. If I call you, you have to pick up the phone. That I can live with.
Bill Murray, what was it like to work opposite Robert De Niro? And I'm thinking, you know, you're such a verbal guy and you're so good at improvising, and De Niro seems much less verbal.
Well, he is less verbal, but he's also he's a hardworking guy and he's serious about his job. I tend to, like, keep it light and goof around on the set just so I'm relaxed. And that got a little distracting for him at one point. I remember one day thinking, oh, God, he was like, yeah, can we just do this here now? You know, so... But we've become friends. I like talking to him. You know, I think he likes my verbal qualities, and I like his sort of surprising sense of humor. And I delighted in really pushing him, you know, and getting him, like if he was supposed to be angry in a scene and I was behind the camera, I would infuriate him. I would enrage him, you know.
How?
Well, I mean, he's a man who demands respect. That's one thing. You have to respect him. And if you disrespect him, he goes crazy. You know, he will really not like you, you know. But in character, you could get away with that. You could disrespect him, and it would enrage him. And he's, you know, he's very proud of his heritage, too, you know. And if you somehow didn't respect the heritage, you would see something happen in his eyes that was just terrifying, really scary. So if you called him, you know, used an Italian slur of some sort, he would just... He could not control himself. He grew up where he grew up in the downtown. You know, there was an Italian neighborhood, and they had their turf, and they were very protective of their own. You know, anybody from the outside was a potential troublemaker, and those insults were a throwdown. You know, and you don't speak that way. If you spoke that way, you're just asking for real trouble. You know, and it had to be responded to. You know.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Bill Murray. When she spoke with him in 1999, she asked him about his role in Kingpin, which is directed by the Farrelly brothers, who also directed the raunchy comedies Something About Mary and Dumb and Dumber.
They have more fun making movies than anybody I've ever worked with. It really is a riot. They will not stop at any... They will go to any length.
Yes, exactly right. They won't stop at anything. And were there times when you decided, no, that's too broad. We ought to stop here.
Well, I didn't see everything that was in the movie. And when I finally did see the movie, I was, oh, God, I went, holy cow. Because I was happy with all my stuff because I did all my stuff. But the stuff I hadn't seen, I was just, oh, man, oh, God. You know, it was rough. The first scene of the movie is so rough. And I'd taken my boys, and they were, I don't know, I thought it'd be okay to take them to this movie. I think they were like 14 and 11 or 13 and 10 or something. And they were shocked, really shocked. I mean, the first scene of the movie involves, sex with an extremely unflatteringly painted woman, you know. Not a painted woman, but a woman that's made to appear just... almost like grisly, you know, and there it's like retching and terrible. And I was stunned into total, like, ice, goose flesh, hair standing up on your skin silence through the entire movie. And we left the movie theater thinking, oh my God, what have I done taking him to this thing? And we walked in silence from the movie to the car, which was in an underground parking lot. We must have walked 3/8 of a mile. And my 10-year-old finally said, you were good, Dad. It was really sad. I felt like, you know, the child services was going to come and, you know, take me in. You took them to that? But so their taste goes beyond mine. You know, I wish I could work with them all the time and have Final Cut. You know, because I'd say, okay, just, we don't have to do this one here, but all this stuff, they have so much funny stuff that they do.
I'm going to ask you to choose a scene that you improvised in part from Kingpin.
Oh, well, I don't know. There's one line that I improvised in the, I don't know if this is a play on the radio, there was a scene that I improvised the one line of. And it's a scene where I'm eating breakfast with Woody. And this guy just hits on anybody. Is it a peccary? Is that this animal that's in the zoo? It's kind of a small-time pig that they can. It's one of the few animals they have in the Central Park Zoo is a peccary. And they have a thought, and then they want a mate. And then they have a thought, and then they want a mate. It's pretty much that's their pattern. But this guy was like that, where his impulses were basically, I'm fed, and now a woman, please. You know, so I did this. I just sort of made up this line where it's just, and it's a horrible offensive line, but it's my standard of offensiveness, and to show to, you know, as opposed to theirs. Just
okay. Let's hear the scene.
It'll this will offend my people out there. People on my wavelength.
This is Bill Murray in Kingpin.
Young bowler like yourself. The tour can be very difficult, very expensive.
Tankeray and tap.
King coming, sweets. I got a long drive. Do me a favor, will you? Would you mind washing off that perfume before you come back to our table? A little bad luck. If you had it today, all of your dreams can go up in smoke. That's why even we veteran bowlers, we work our way, tournament to tournament. We need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra. That's what it means. You interested?
Interested.
Would you be interested in some extra income?
No, extra income.
You want to make more money? Okay. Why don't you go eat that outside and then come on back in. Hi.
Hello.
Not you. Hi.
Hi.
That's a scene from Kingpin, which was made by the Farrelly brothers, who also made Something About Mary and Dumb and Dumber. And just in case our listeners couldn't make out the final words of that scene, can you tell us what you were saying to the women at the next table?
I said, no, not you. You.
Right.
It's just a guy who's hitting on women at the next table, and one woman responds and goes, no, not you, you. I mean, I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to the lady next to you. And it just came into my head at that moment, and it was so horrible, such a horrible thing to say, that there was a moment of complete disbelief, and then everyone laughed really hard because it was, you know, the guy should be taken out and shot. You know?
I know you have to go, so I'll just ask you one more question. Mm. Are you ever able to kind of sneak into lounges and watch lounge singer types?
Well, they usually catch me after a little while, and sometimes they get extremely nervous. Even the music, especially the musicians backing up, because they're like, oh, God. Because the guy performing may not get it anyway. You know, he may not be a... They're often in their own little world, you know, so they don't even...
They actually think they're good.
They're out, yeah, and they're out of focus to the audience anyway. They don't really see. So it's fun to see the musicians behind them, and they'll spot me and go, oh, God. You know, and they'll be embarrassed because they are backing up a guy that is the guy that I did on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And they'll be, like, winking, going, yeah, it's as bad as you say, and we got to do this every night. It's funny.
Well, Bill Murray, it's really been a pleasure. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. I've enjoyed talking to you, too.
Well, good night, everybody. And this is Nick Summer saying a Minnehaha summer is a fun summer. That's what you're here for. That's what I'm here for. I am a fun guy, and I hope that you had fun tonight. Saying one more thing. I want you just to remember to sing. That's right. Sing a song. Sing it loud. Sing it short. Remember to put on some 612 when you go out. Sing it happy, not sad. You know, we got bears over the garbage dump. Just flash your headlights. Sing of the good times and not the bad. Well, no matter if it's not good enough. This is my seventh summer up here for anyone else to hear. Just sing, sing a song. Please, won't you sing me a song? Thank you.
Bill Murray speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. Murray is up for an Academy Award for his role in the film Lost in Translation.